At first sight, it looks like an appallingly bad sales pitch. A middle-aged bachelor teaching English literature at Oxford University volunteers to write some children's stories. You can see the suggestion going straight into the waste paper basket in most publishers' offices. So, why does it work? If it works? And what was C.S. Lewis trying to do in writing The Chronicles of Narnia? These seven fantasies which explore a kind of overlap between this world and an alternative universe. Some people have come up with a very simple explanation of what he was doing, which, like most simple explanations of almost anything, doesn't work very well. And that is that this was a point, the beginning of the 1950s, in the life of C.S. Lewis, when he was feeling rather doubtful about some of his more intellectual efforts in defending the Christian faith. He'd had a rather bad time at a debate in Oxford with the formidable and terrible philosopher Elizabeth Anscombe. Some of us here present bear the scars of Professor Anscombe in later life. And so he sought security in going back to his childhood and writing fairy tales. And indeed, Lewis himself gives a little bit of colour to that suggestion when he says in a remark about the books that he was simply writing the kind of stories he would like to read. But it's not quite good enough, partly because the story about his defeat in debate with Professor Anscombe in Oxford is not nearly as simple as that, but partly because the Narnia books, while they may be, indeed are, lastingly successful stories for children, are not always just comforting or consoling. If these were the kind of stories that C.S. Lewis felt he would like to be able to read, that does some credit to his appetite for challenge in his reading material. You can also see how in the Narnia books, themes and images cross-cut and reflect with some of the other books he was writing around the same period. Some books he had written in the 1940s, some later in the 1950s. And perhaps specially interesting and important for understanding some of the themes in the Narnia books is a book he published in 1945 called The Great Divorce, which can best be described as a comic book about hell. It's a picture of all the ways in which human beings can get themselves completely stuck inside their own heads, with fantasies, with pride, with fear, and how that forms a very effective prison for us in this life and the life to come. And in these three nights, I'll be referring from time to time to that book, The Great Divorce. But the bottom line is that Lewis's Narnia books are very much of a piece with his whole concern as a defender and proponent of the Christian faith. He writes in one of his letters that there's a lot to be said for writing little books with their Christian message obscured. He adds that he put forward this idea at dinner in the Jesuit house in Oxford and was told it was Jesuitical. Not entirely a compliment. But Lewis was particularly gifted in writing books that did indeed have a buried Christian agenda. You may think that's unfair in some ways. Lewis, though, was prepared to be, in his own terms, quite as unfair as God. He writes in his autobiography, that a young atheist cannot be too careful. The world is absolutely full of traps whereby God may slip in unnoticed. That's part, at least, of what Lewis was trying to do with these fantasies. And you might perhaps represent his purpose in these terms. We still live, even now, and even more so in Lewis's time, we still live in a culture where there's some vague recollection of something called the Christian faith. We have a dim awareness, it gets dimmer every year, of what Christmas and Easter are about. We know there was this man called Jesus who allegedly had something to do with God, whoever God is. That's common knowledge. And like all common knowledge, it's rather stale. The question for any defender of Christian faith is, how do you make it fresh? So Lewis sets out with the question, how do you depict a world in which God is active? What does it feel to be in a world where God is around? So, if you want to answer that question, try making up a world in which you can ask this and answer it without preconceptions. That world is Narnia. A world in which Christian language is, of course, absent. And yet, we are gradually introduced to some understanding of what it feels like to live in a world where there is God. Now, Narnia is, at one level, a parallel universe, as I've already called it. It's a whole world, a whole framework of reality. But Narnia is also the name of a country within that world. The Kingdom of Narnia is part of a larger map, on which there are other nations, like Calamine, famously, to the south. And Narnia, in that second sense, is a little bit like the chosen people in the biblical story, because it's in the history of Narnia that the action of God comes through in a specially strong, visible way. And the kingdom of Narnia, within this whole universe of Narnia, the kingdom of Narnia has some very specific characteristics. Notably, it has talking animals. And I suspect, and I'll say more about this later, I suspect that one of the things, at least, that Lewis is doing by taking us into a world with talking animals is to make us think again about what human beings are really like. If you have intelligent animals who relate to God just as human beings do, well, maybe human beings are going to look a little bit different. Maybe some of the pride or arrogance in the minds of human beings may be ever so slightly qualified by the recognition that for certain very important purposes, you are on the same spiritual level as a badger or a mouse. I mention those because they have very particular roles in these books. So, it's not just about imagining God in a new way. It's also about imagining your own humanity in a new way. And that's part of the reason for the fact that the Narnia books work very much as what Lewis himself described, writing about another novelist, as a mouthwash for the imagination. Rinse out your mind and your imagination. Make it fresh. And come to the Christian story as if you'd never heard it before. Well, One or two more preliminary remarks before I turn to the main subject for this evening. Before anybody says it, yes, the Narnia books are very much marked by the spirit of the 1950s. They are politically incorrect in any number of ways. It's not only the atmosphere of the 1950s, it's also the fact that Lewis himself was a pretty conservative character, even for the 1950s. There's some rather facile satire which doesn't entirely work. His targets are not always well placed, and there's an element of the sledgehammer about. There's a fair bit of sexism, though not as much as some people think. Lewis may have unenlightened ideas about women, but it's still not at all insignificant that some of the most decisive changes in the stories are the result of women taking action and holding up a mirror of judgment to lazy or stupid men. There's a very fine moment in one of the books where the children have got themselves lost, and one of the boys says, "The trouble with girls is they can't keep a map in their heads." One of the girls replies promptly, "That's because we have something in them already." So, in case anyone concludes too quickly that Lewis was a completely unreconstructed male supremacist, just bear some of that in mind. There's also the problem of Calomene, the neighbouring kingdom to Narnia. The people of Calomene are darker skinned, they wear turbans and they carry scimitars, they have a different religion, they engage in slave trading and raids on Narnia, and it would be a very dim person who didn't feel that the Arab world was somewhere in the background of all that. Lewis knew very little indeed about the Arab world and about Islam. It wouldn't be fair to say that Calomene is meant to be, as some Christian commentators have argued, a picture of Islam. The religion of the Calomenes has lots of gods, human sacrifice, and all kinds of things which a Muslim would abhor as much as a Christian. But Lewis certainly gives some hostages to fortune. The Calamines talk like the Arabian Nights. That is, they talk in highly elaborate, extremely courteous, devious ways. One of the most comic chapters in The Horse and His Boy, and let no one say the books are short on comedy, is a conversation between the Emperor of Calamine, his son, and the Grand Vizier. And I can't resist sharing with you just a brief extract from that. Here we have one of the princesses eavesdropping on this conversation. The Emperor of Calamine is called the Tisroch. "How well it was said by a gifted poet," observed the vizier, raising his face in a somewhat dusty condition from the carpet, "that deep draughts from the fountain of reason are desirable in order to extinguish the fire of youthful love." This seemed to exasperate the prince. "Dog," he shouted, directing a series of well-aimed kicks at the hindquarters of the vizier. "Do not dare to quote the poets to me. I have had verses flung at me all day." The Tisroch was apparently sunk in thought. But when, after a long pause, he noticed what was happening, he said tranquilly, "My son, by all means desist from kicking the venerable and enlightened vizier. For as a costly jewel retains its value even if hidden in a dunghill, so old age and discretion are to be respected even in the vile persons of our subjects. Desist, therefore." It's a mixture of the Arabian Nights, and for those who may perhaps recognize it, also those bizarre little fantasies by Ernest Bramah about Kai Lung, a mythical Chinese aristocrat, who again speaks in the same over-elaborate way. Well, you cannot entirely acquit Lewis of prejudice. He is emphatically a man of his time. But one of the most interesting things about these stories, as I hope we shall see, is that Lewis manages to challenge and sometimes to undermine his own prejudices, or at least to give us the material for questioning some of his own assumptions by the sheer vigour and depth and energy of the story. At the heart of all the Narnia books is, of course, the figure of Aslan, the king of the wood, the king of Narnia, the son of the great emperor overseas, the lion. And in The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, Aslan's appearance is very carefully prepared for. And it's worth noting just how Lewis does this. In The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, the children who have come through the wardrobe and find themselves in the unfamiliar landscape of Narnia are welcomed by Mr. and Mrs. Beaver. Narnia, as you'll recall, is under the control of the White Witch and her secret police. It's a totalitarian state, but the fabric is crumbling. And Mr. Beaver whispers, "They say Aslan is on the move, perhaps has already landed." Lewis goes on. "And now a very curious thing happened. None of the children knew who Aslan was any more than you do. But the moment the beaver had spoken these words, everyone felt quite different. Perhaps it has sometimes happened to you in a dream that someone says something which you don't understand, but in the dream, it feels as if it has some enormous meaning." At the name of Aslan, each one of the children felt something jump in its inside. Lucy got the feeling you have when you wake up in the morning and realize that it's the beginning of the holidays or the beginning of summer. Aslan's arrival is prepared for. Prepared for by giving the message that somehow or other, whoever or whatever Aslan is, he is going to be the focus of the most significant, deeply buried emotions in these human children. Without knowing anything of Aslan, reader or character, we are shown what Aslan can do. But there's more to it than that. Aslan is introduced, first and foremost, as somebody who is about to upset the existing order. And I don't think this has been sufficiently recognized in the way The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe works. Aslan is a rebel against the White Witch. He may be the rightful king of Narnia, but he can only attain his throne by overthrowing the order of things as they are. And so again, the emotion that is triggered by that is to do with protest, pushing back at the tyranny of the White Witch. Now that's a technique that C.S. Lewis likes to use very much in his work, turning things around in this way so that Christianity, faith, love, whatever, appear to be unexpectedly exciting and disturbing. It's a technique that I think he got from G.K. Chesterton. Those of you who've read Chesterton's lovely book, The Man Who Was Thursday, will remember that the point of it is that everybody should have the excitement of being an anarchist. The Man Who Was Thursday turns on a conspiracy of anarchists. And it transpires, as the book unfolds, that the person who's organized this is in fact the embodiment of law and order, because he believes everyone needs the thrill of rebellion. And they have to discover that God, truth, is found in rebellion against the clichés of the world. And in a slightly different way, you see it, of course, in the Screwtape Letters of C.S. Lewis, where a man trying to live a fairly good life is seen relentlessly from the perspective of the devils. They know exactly what's good for them and good for everybody, and their purpose is to control everyone and everything. They cannot understand why God has put into the universe these creatures who have choices and who are interested in enjoying themselves. So that the Screwtape Letters is largely about the battle between a joyless hell and joyful virtue. Lewis, in another of his letters, quotes an essay he's just read in the Oxford Examination Schools about Milton's Paradise Lost. He quotes the essay with great admiration and says that the student speaks of the ordered world of sin, which the demons propose in Paradise Lost. Evil and sin are orderly. They are closed. They're all about cause and effect. They're not about freedom. And whether in the Screwtape Letters or in other books like That Hideous Strength, the last of his science fiction trilogy, the tipping point of understanding the good news is again and again the idea that virtue, holiness, God are subversive. So when Aslan appears in more than one book, he brings with him a kind of anarchy. He brings with him an alternative to the philosophy wonderfully expressed in the very last of the Narnia books, The Last Battle, where the ape, who is seeking to control Narnia through a false Aslan, explodes, speaking to the crowds with great exasperation, "True freedom means doing what I tell you." Aslan has other ideas. At the end of The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, in chapter 16, we see him bringing the statues to life, the statues of those who've been turned to stone by the White Witch. And the whole of that sequence in the last few chapters of The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe is about Aslan as a kind of rush of living energy. He literally breathes life into stone. And, of course, among those into whom he breathes life is the frozen little Christmas dinner party, whose joy and festivity has so angered the White Witch a few chapters earlier that she's turned them all to stone in a fit of temper. They're woken up, they're made flesh again, so that they can rejoice. And in Prince Caspian, once again towards the end, we see what happens when the true ruler of Narnia is restored and Aslan sets things right, in a chapter wonderfully entitled How All Were Very Busy. Here we encounter a school, a girls' school, where a lot of Narnian girls with their hair done very tight and ugly tight collars round their necks and thick tickly stockings on their legs were having a history lesson. The sort of history that was taught in Narnia under Mirazi's rule was duller than the truest history you ever read, and less true than the most exciting adventure story. If you don't attend, Gwendolyn, said the mistress, and stop looking out of the window, I shall have to give you an order mark. But please, Miss Prizzle, began Gwendolyn. Did you hear what I said, Gwendolyn? Asked Miss Prizzle. But please, Miss Prizzle, said Gwendolyn, there's a lion. Take two order marks for talking nonsense, said Miss Prizzle. And now, a roar interrupted her. The little girls mostly run, but Gwendolyn hesitated. You'll stay with us, sweetheart, said Aslan. Oh, may I? Thank you, said Gwendolyn. And the scene is repeated, this time with a boys' school and an exhausted, demoralized schoolmistress. A tired-looking girl was teaching arithmetic to a number of boys who looked very like pigs. Aslan stopped right under the window and looked up at her. Oh, don't, she said. I'd love to, but I mustn't. I must stick to my work, and the children will be frightened if they saw you. Frightened, said the most pig-like of the boys. Who's she talking to out of the window? Let's go and see who it is, said another boy. And they all came crowding to the window, with the results you might expect. Now, dear heart, said Aslan to the mistress, and she jumped down and joined them. The riotous scenes of this chapter, made even more riotous by the presence of all people, of Bacchus and Silenus from classical mythology. Silenus, royally drunk, just as he is in Greek mythology. This riot is an instance of Aslan being subversive. And that subversiveness of good order, the good order of sin, the world of control and predictability, and Miss Prizzle, all of that is what Aslan comes to upset. There's just a hint of it in his earlier book, which I've mentioned, That Hideous Strength. In that book, quite late on, Jane, one of the central female characters, is trying to make some beds in order for the arrival of guests, a married couple who actually haven't seen each other for quite a long time. And Lewis is perfectly clear about what they will want to do in the beds when they've got together again. Her attempt to make the beds tidily is upset by the intrusion of a crowd of manic little gnomes who rush around the room, tearing up the bedclothes, covering the place with feathers, and making themselves thoroughly objectionable to Jane, who may be an agnostic, though not for long, but is also a little bit of a Puritan. And it's something of her Puritanism that is upset by the sheer energy that, in this case, some rather distant touch of the divine brings into that room. And all of that, of course, is captured very, very effectively by the sheer fact that, well, Aslan is an animal. Lewis fuses together animal physicality, the reference at the end of The Silver Chair to the wild kisses of a lion. Goodness knows what that's like, but the imagination is certainly set to work. A fusion of that animal energy with intelligence and warmth of a superhuman kind. It's quite a risk writing in that vein, but most readers of Narnia would agree that it's quite a successful risk. So, he's not a tame lion. That's a phrase which occurs more than once in the books, and we first meet something like it once again in the encounter with Mr. and Mrs. Beaver. The children are informed by the beavers that Aslan is not, after all, a man, he's a lion. Then he isn't safe, said Lucy. Safe? Said Mr. Beaver. Who said anything about safe? Of course he isn't safe, but he's good. I'll say a bit more tomorrow on how the mixture of wildness and severity and love works. But it's very central to the way in which Aslan is imagined in these books, that he's not a tame lion. There is a wildness about him. As I've said, an anarchy. But here's one of the extraordinary achievements of Lewis's books. In the last battle, the last of the sequence, this theme is turned on its head very, very powerfully. As I've said, this is a story about how a crafty and ambitious ape seeks to dominate Narnia, disguising a rather confused old donkey in a second-hand lion skin and pretending that he is Aslan, so that he can be the mouthpiece for the ape. In other words, this is an antichrist figure. The ape justifies and reinforces what he wants by saying, "This is what Aslan wants," pointing to the donkey. And when people wonder what on earth is going on, when the ape starts doing some very bizarre and very unpleasant things, what occurs to people in response is precisely, he's not a tame lion. You never know what Aslan is going to do. So if Aslan starts giving orders to cut down the forests, or to make treaties with the enemy, or to take people as slaves, well, he's not a tame lion. In fact, the language of Aslan's wildness has itself become tame. It's become a cliché in Narnia. Nobody's seen Aslan for quite a long time. When the donkey asks Shift, the ape, "What if the real Aslan turns up?" the ape replies memorably, "He never does turn up." So we see, bit by bit, how people are confused, manipulated, and dominated by the ape because they have this vague recollection that Aslan's not tame. Even the most obviously good characters here, Tyrion, the King of Narnia, and his allies, even they wonder a bit. After all, he's made the laws of Narnia. Is he bound by his own laws? There have been no signs in the sky, in the stars, to predict a new coming of Aslan. But he's not the slave of the stars. And so it goes on. And eventually, there comes a very poignant moment. Tyrion and his associates have finally discovered the poor old donkey in the lion's skin. They exhibit the donkey to prove that everyone has been misled by the ape. And they're not believed, because people have seen a false god exposed, and so they conclude there is no true god. Where is he then, this Aslan? Can you produce him? And the response is, of course, you can't just produce Aslan. He's not just another thing. He's not a tame lion. "Who am I that I could make Aslan appear at my bidding?" says King Tyrion. "He's not a tame lion." The moment those words were out of his mouth, he realized he'd made a false move. The dwarves at once began repeating, "Not a tame lion, not a tame lion," in a jeering sing-song. "That's what the other lot kept on telling us," said one. And the bleakness of that moment is precisely that false religion has driven out the possibility of true. The language has become so stale that nobody knows how to put any content back into it. And I do think that is one of the most remarkable achievements in these books. Lewis taking one of his own most powerful phrases and ideas, the wonderful imagery of the wildness of God, and saying, even that can become a cliché. Even that can become a tool of falsehood. He seems to suggest that we've got somehow to learn how to distinguish two different kinds of anarchy. There's the anarchy, the chaos, that comes with grace, with love. The anarchy that breaks the tyranny of laws we impose on ourselves or the oppressive rule of others. The tyranny represented in trivial ways by Miss Prizzle in the school and not so trivial ways by the White Witch. This is an anarchy, this is a chaos, whose purpose is to set free joy for everyone. But on the other side is the anarchy of real lawlessness. And we're reminded again and again that Aslan keeps his own laws. In The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, when it's briefly suggested that perhaps he doesn't have to die after all, Aslan reminds everyone that he is bound by the law which he embodies. He cannot refuse the sacrifice demanded because that's how the universe is. And again, in The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, we find something similar, the reminder that he keeps his own laws, he is faithful to his own nature at the end of the day. And the trouble is that having the skill to distinguish those two kinds of chaos, those two kinds of anarchy, is going to take time. You need to grow up into it. And we'll see later on this week a bit of what Lewis has to say about growing up in discernment. In short, Aslan is a very risky presence to have around. There's no way of meeting him without risk. And at the beginning of The Silver Chair, we have one of the most striking, almost poetic encounters that brings this home. Jill has just escaped into Narnia, much to her own surprise, from bullying at school. And for the first time, she sees the lion. She's desperately thirsty. She wants to drink. Next to the lion is a pool of water, and she is terrified of the lion and consumed with thirst. What is she to do? The lion says, "If you're thirsty, you may drink." Jill is terrified. "Are you not thirsty?" said the lion. "I'm dying of thirst," said Jill. "Then drink," said the lion. "Would you mind going away while I do?" said Jill. The lion answered this only by a look and a very low growl. And as Jill gazed at its motionless bulk, she realized that she might as well have asked the whole mountain to move aside for her convenience. The delicious rippling noise of the stream was driving her nearly frantic. "Will you promise not to do anything to me if I do come?" said Jill. "I make no promise," said the lion. Jill was so thirsty now that without noticing it, she'd come a step nearer. Do you eat girls?" she said. "I have swallowed up girls and boys, women and men, kings and emperors, cities and realms," said the lion. It didn't say this as if it were boasting, nor as if it were sorry, nor as if it were angry. It just said it. "I daren't come and drink," said Jill. "Then you will die of thirst," said the lion. "Oh dear," said Jill, coming another step nearer. "I suppose I must go and look for another stream then." "There is no other stream," said the lion. That rather haunting episode, "I make no promise, there is no other stream," is a reminder of something we'll have to think about more tomorrow and the day after. And that is the element of what you can only call relentlessness about Aslan. Aslan makes no promise. He's not safe. Nothing can prevent that sense of profound risk as you approach this immense, anarchic, literally, force of nature. And does he eat girls? He eats anything and everything. But as another character says in The Horse and His Boy, face to face with Aslan, "I'd rather be eaten by you than fed by anyone else." Nothing can avoid the risk around Aslan, even the risk of trivializing and corrupting faith through power and sin, as happens in the last battle. But there is no other stream. Aslan, you might say, can't help being the truth. And he can't stop being the truth. And when you come up against the truth makes no promises, but there's nowhere else to go. At a very intense point in The Magician's Nephew, the young hero of that book, Diggory, is arguing with the White Witch in one of her earlier manifestations. Aslan has told Diggory what he must and must not do, and the witch says, "What's the point of giving his trust to a wild animal in a strange world that is no business of yours?" Diggory is called at that point to a blind faith that is profoundly costly because he's given his trust to a wild animal in a strange world. But there's no way round. There is no other stream. There's no bargaining with Aslan. Diggory thinks for one wild moment earlier on that he might be able to negotiate with Aslan for a better outcome, and then realizes that's not on. And so it's up to us whether we die of thirst or risk everything. And of course, Aslan is not out to make it easy, because truth is truth. He can't break his own laws. He can't stop being what he is. That doesn't always translate into easy or quick assurances for those he encounters. And there are times, as with Diggory in that episode, and as later in The Silver Chair, when the darkness is apparently impenetrable, and yet there's nowhere else to go. In the pivotal scene in The Silver Chair, the two children are in an underground realm where, yet again, a witch is trying to persuade them that they have never lived above ground, that the world above ground, the fresh air, is a myth. They only think they've been there. They're making up analogies from what they've seen. Look, there's a light, a lamp in the ceiling, and so they imagine that somewhere up there, there's a lamp in the sky called the sun. "But we've seen it," they say. "Yes, think you have," says the witch. And gradually, this persuasive, insinuating negativity sinks deeper and deeper into them. And they begin to say that, indeed, they were never there. Fortunately, with them is Puddleglum, the marsh wiggle, another of Lewis's great comic creations. The perennially depressed, frog-like, gaunt assistant or guardian that they've acquired in their travels. A marsh dweller with flat webbed feet and a perpetually depressed attitude to life. And it's Puddleglum, curiously and wonderfully, who realizes what's wrong. Puddleglum stamps out the fire in the underground cavern on which sweet herbs have been burning, giving a seductive, drugging effect. "One word, ma'am," he said, coming back from the fire, limping because of the pain. "One word. All you've been saying is quite right, I shouldn't wonder. I'm a chap who always like to know the worst and then put the best face I can on it. So I won't deny any of what you said, but there's one more thing to be said even so. Suppose we have only dreamed or made up all those things, trees and grass and sun and moon and stars and Aslan himself. Suppose we have. Well, all I can say is, in that case, made-up things seem a good deal more important than the real ones. Suppose this black pit of a kingdom of yours is the only world. Well, strikes me as a pretty poor one. That's a funny thing when you come to think of it. We're just babies making up a game, if you're right. But four babies playing a game can make a play world which licks your real world hollow. That's why I'm going to stand by the play world. I'm on Aslan's side, even if there isn't any Aslan to lead it. I'm going to live as like a Narnian as I can, even if there isn't any Narnia. So, thanking you kindly for our supper, if these two gentlemen and the young lady are ready, we're leaving. It's apparently a long way from Puddleglum to St. John of the Cross and the Dark Night of the Soul, but I suspect that the 16th century Carmelite might just have recognised Puddleglum as a kindred spirit. And the god, I use the word at last, who appears in that story, as in all of them, is one who can't make truth untrue and can't make salt water fresh. If you want salt water to be fresh, you're in for suffering and disappointment. On the other hand, there's fresh water to be had without limit, if you know where to look for it. Thank you. We've some time for questions. Somebody right at the back. Would you like to stand up and then they can see where you are? Thanks, a very, very good question, I think, because it is one of the things that troubles a lot of people in the Narnia stories, that there is that element of winning by violence. I think it's particularly strong in Prince Caspian, which is more like a conventional adventure story than most of them. The two things which would qualify the judgment a bit are, of course, that in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, the crucial victory is won by sacrifice, and the battle afterwards is almost an afterthought. And in the last battle, the forces of good, as we might say, are defeated, and it's only the advent of basically the end of the world that changes things. And I think what we're up against here is two things. One is the fact that Lewis is writing, in a sense, conventional old-fashioned adventure stories, and I'll have a bit to say about this on Wednesday. He's got an attitude to death, and even violent death, which is perfectly in place in adventure stories, but grates quite a bit on the contemporary reader. And that's rooted in, I think, the second dimension, his own deep appreciation of a sort of tradition of romances of chivalry, knights in armour, Malory and King Arthur. And he imports a great deal of that into the events of the novels. There is a kind of grating feeling about some of it. And I think particularly at the end of The Silver Chair, isn't it? The return of Eustace and Jill to the school where she's been bullied, a rather disagreeable scene of humiliation and physical violence. So I don't exonerate Lewis from some contradictions there. They are there. I think they have to be set against those deeper underlying themes in which what finally changes things isn't battle, but conversion. Who else? Solemn silence. Oh, good, somebody's breaking the silence. Over there, would you like to stand, please? Thank you. That's very insightful, I think. Yes, Lewis had, of course, fought in the war. He wasn't someone who glorified modern war at all, but he clearly believed that there was such a thing as old-fashioned military virtue, courage in battle, and that's where the, as I say, the romances of chivalry come in some of these books. I think that there is still an ambivalence here, and I think also of the appalling ending of That Hideous Strength, the third of the science fiction books, where the villains are the objects of an absolute carnage. It's a real parental guidance bloodbath at the end of That Hideous Strength. And although Lewis says, well, of course, these are people who'd sort of stopped being human, really, so you needn't worry about them, that's a rather disturbing way of excusing it. And a bit of that goes on even in the Narnia books. You don't have to worry too much about dead foreigners, you know? And it is there. But you're quite right to source it back to some of his own personal experience, I'm sure. He's, I suppose, also reminding us, and I say this tentatively as someone who's, as you know, not wild about warfare, something about genuine virtue in situations of conflict, genuine chivalry in conflict, which an age of kind of mass mechanized warfare has largely forgotten about. We don't really understand as moderns what it just might have felt like a few hundred years ago to think of conflict as honorable. I'm not saying it's necessarily a right or good attitude, but it's there. We've lost it. Lewis occasionally gives us a bit of a glimpse of it. Yes, there's one just here. Sorry.
It has a lot of nuances and contradictions in it itself. Yes, absolutely.
Sure, thank you. Thank you not least because that's a good curtain raiser for what I'd like to talk about a bit tomorrow night too. Because certainly when there is an encounter between Aslan and untruth or injustice, even without the slightly melodramatic violence in some of the narratives, there's always a collision. Something happens which hurts. And I think that's a perfectly fair description of peace not as the world gives, in biblical terms. This is not an easy peace, and in the last battle, the idea that Narnians and Calamines just ought to agree that Aslan and the false god of Calamine are the same, that really won't do. There has to be a collision. And at the same time, of course, Lewis can rather remarkably retrieve something even from that and say, and yet, even those who are serving the false god in good faith have got something you can work with. So it's quite a nuanced approach, I think. Aslan, as a wild lion, is emphatically a presence who brings conflict, who brings things to a head. And I think it's quite right to say that you can't just appeal to peace and say, well, he ought not to be making such a fuss about it. Because, as I said at the end, he can't help being the truth, so to speak. So where he is, things bump into him with complex results. I think we may have time for one more, and there's somebody waving a sheet back there. Oh, sorry. I'm sorry, two more. I had one in the queue. Oh, I'm sorry, yes. The last question, by the way, was about peace and the various meanings of peace, and is it always kind of passively accepting things? Answer, I think, no, in a nutshell. Yes.
I think your talk based on offense, the Narnian story is about an angry ambition to pay. I think that there is possibly an occasion denying that, but then you will answer it. But do you think also, as you hinted at this at the beginning of the report, it might also, there might also be an allegory of own life and sufferings, in particular, the cosmic of his experience of his dying life?
I don't think that the Narnia stories are an allegory, and I think Lewis was very reluctant indeed to use the word allegory. That's why I was trying to say at the beginning that he's attempting to evoke for us what it might feel like for God to become real in someone's life. In that sense, it is about his experience. Hence, the allusion I made to his own remark, a young atheist can't be too careful. I think it's a mistake to look for allegories at every point in the Narnia books. They're stories that have their own logic, their own integrity, you might say. But it is very difficult not to see The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe as very consciously replaying a certain view of salvation. And there are moments here and there in the later books, and I'll mention them tomorrow and Wednesday, where the allusions are a bit more pointed. As to the whole relation with his own experience, well, people have noted that the alarming, overwhelming, castrating female figure that occurs in the books does have quite a bit to do with Lewis's psyche and his early experience, not just with Professor Anscombe. Lewis's relations with women were very complex. He spent many years of his adult life living with a much older woman who was clearly both a supportive and inspiring presence and also a tremendously inhibiting and complicating presence. He was, of course, when he wrote the Narnia books, not yet married to Joy Davidman, whose tragic death he then reflected on so astonishingly in his book A Grief Observed, So I don't think that plays a role at this juncture. And yes, one more, I did promise. Sorry. Behind you. Thank you. Is it significant that Lewis uses children to make these big points and stories? I think one of the great advantages of his casting this enterprise in terms of children's books and using children as main characters is that you can watch children changing and growing, perhaps a bit more easily than you could with adults. They come with less baggage. They're more open to the unsettling experience that they're about to have. And also, I think, quite deliberately at times, he uses the little squabbles that the children have between themselves as a way almost of looking over the heads of readers to the adult and saying, now come on, you still do this, don't you? And the little games of mutual blame and resentment that the children play, very recognizable as childish behavior, and therefore very nakedly a challenge to the adult reader as well. So I think there is some real depth and solidity to his choice of coming at it through children. Of course, they're children's books, but he writes to children for the same reason that he uses children as characters. He wants to address an audience that is receptive, capable of being excited. And it's no bad thing. I think we should probably pause at this point for those who need to leave, and then we'll gather again for worship in about 5-10 minutes' time.